Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, August 9th. I'm Ray Graff. Time once again for the Science Forum on the program, and we welcome back the experts to answer all of your scientific questions. We'll talk about rogue planets, the persistence of memory, how to get your laundry smelling fresh, whatever you want. The number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Three brilliant people and a radio person are here to help you through the next hour. And again, the number is 800-348-2551. We'll be back. Well, howdy do. Welcome back to the Vox Pop program. It's our live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we reconvene the Science Forum, and the experts are here. They are champing at the bit. The number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. If you have a scientific question, or even one that's, a soft science, they'll give it a shot. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. But the number is 800-348-2551. This is the exciting part where our scientists sign in, please.
Ooh, excitement. This is Barbara Brabetz. I'm a biochemist from SUNY Cobleskill.
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist, retired.
And an editor of a very fine journal.
Fine journal.
What's the journal again?
Polymer Degradation and Stability.
By the way, my issue did not arrive this month.
I'll tell the publisher.
Have you checked the bathroom?
I did.
Well, the mailmen often take it home to read themselves.
And polymers will break down in the sun if you're not careful.
Yes. You see. And then the wiseacre here is?
Ed Stander. I am the geologist, astronomer, environmental scientist who covers pretty well all scientific endeavors apart from chemistry.
Okay. And so you feel that you're pretty smart?
I'm certainly smarter than the average chemist.
Fair enough.
Not that there are any average chemists in the room. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Our number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. If I recall, Barbara, you wanted to talk about memory.
I did. There was a lot of press this week about an advance that was published in eNeuro, which is another one of these magazines that's in your bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
It's an online magazine only, so careful with the tablet near the water.
Yeah.
But some researchers from UCLA did a series of experiments to find out what is the molecular component that can create memory and transfer memory.
Mm.
And what they came up with, and bear with me, is they took a snail and they shock treated the snail so that the snail would flinch whenever the shocker came and touched its hind end.
Okay.
So it created a flinch response. Just think of the puppy that's been naughty and then it flinches when it sees the hand.
Mm-hmm.
Then they took RNA, which is genetic material but not DNA, and they transferred it from that snail to another snail that had never been through that protocol and found that that snail would flinch when the probe was put on its hind end. So it could transfer the memory from the one snail to the other snail. So that the second snail that had never gone through the protocol still had that same flinch response.
So what does this tell us about collective memory?
Well, I don't know about collective.
Inherited memory.
Oh, boy. So one of the researchers in an article, I think it was in CNN, on their website, talked about the fact that this is just the alphabet. We haven't built words yet. We haven't created sentences. And we certainly haven't written a book yet. So this is very, very preliminary steps to understand how memory is stored and how memory is transferred. There's a lot of debate about the majority of thought is that memories are stored in your synapses, which is kind of this gap piece between nerves. But this shows that it wouldn't be synapse space, that it would actually be in the nuclei of the neuron, which is the kind of the long stringy thing in between the synapses. There is some other research that bears this out, but of course we have just started. But, you know, we were talking before the break about all the things that could happen. Like if I could create organic chemistry on a stick with RNA and then give that to my students, then I put myself out of business. But we're a long way off from that. I mean, we've just gotten a flinching snail for
flinching snail.
Yeah, that's all we've gotten.
It's the name of my new band.
I'm thinking it's a great band name.
On the other hand,
a lot of students do that in organic chemistry.
They flinch.
They flinch.
All you have to say is organic chemistry, and they'll flinch.
So, what do you think about that, Ed? You claim to be pretty smart.
Well, I've inherited most of my intelligence from my parents.
Now, nobody go probing into a snail's head to go find out what their memories are. I think that's just a little too much.
Fair enough.
Well, that's the interesting thing. How about if you were to take snail RNA and put it in a person, would they flinch?
They did take it from one snail species and move it into a different snail species. And the second snail species was able to flinch in the same way. They even did it with just cells, without an organism. They looked for a response transferred just in the cells.
Wow, that is really cool.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, and this goes right back to the old days when they used to take flatworms and they'd run them through a maze and then chop them up and feed them to another flatworm.
And
the second flatworm would then run the maze.
Right, wow. After he ate his buddies.
Yep. You scientists are real weirdos.
There's forms you have to fill out for that kind of stuff these days.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Ed Standard, Jim Pickett, and Barbara Rabbits are here to answer your questions. And without further ado, let's go to the phones. Bob in West Sand Lake. Bob, you're on.
Yeah, good afternoon. Interestingly enough, just listening to that conversation, there was a biologist from University of Chicago, Dr. Brown, 40 years ago down at the Marine Labs in Woods Hole, showed that you could take a sea urchin that changed its color in relationship to the tide, moved it to another source, another venue, and it would keep changing its color to the original place that it had lived. But anyway, my question is, how on earth do the weather people so accurately define when sunrise and sunset is to the absolute minute?
Okay.
Well, you have to understand that sunrise and sunset is, first of all, it's based on the fact that the Earth is rotating.
I understand. I have a degree in electrical engineering and a degree in physics, so I understand some of this.
Well, you've got a situation where you've got a frictionless system, you've got a planet which doesn't change its shape, and it goes around the sun in a very, very exacting orbit, which doesn't change over time. So those three things together, you can feed them into a computer or anything else for that matter and get the position, the time of sunset at any location on the Earth.
But what is the definition of sunset?
There's three definitions of sunset. There's sunset, there's nautical sunset, there's astronomical sunset, or twilight for each of those things. So depending on what you're doing, you'll get a different answer. But basically, sunset is when the sun goes below the horizon. And that, of course,
completely
below the horizon. Now, that's also a question because you get a certain amount of mirage effect near the edge. But basically, that mirage effect is less than a minute long. So that takes care of that.
In the desert, it used to be for the desert dwellers when you could no longer differentiate between a white thread and a black thread. That was sunset.
That's astronomical sunset.
Okay.
So it all depends on what you're after and what you want to do with it.
All right, Bob, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it. 800-348-2551 is the number. 800-348-2551, the Science Forum. And Mel in Willow. Mel, you're on.
Oh, hi. I'm concerned with, or my question concerns, the exact nature of stars. I know that the essential nature of stars is that a star has at its core a kind of furnace that over millions of years transforms hydrogen atoms into helium, and eventually the hydrogen is exhausted, the supply of hydrogen is exhausted, and something else happens. But what I'm curious about is exactly, how does that process take place? How does a star actually become a star?
How perfect, because we were discussing this rogue planet before the show started, and who wants first?
I think the astronomy professor should teach it.
I see. So you're getting back
chemistry
at me now.
It's a little bit of chemistry.
Okay. Basically, the problem is when you have two atoms of hydrogen, they don't want to get too close to each other, because the electron cloud of one hydrogen atom stays away from the electron cloud of the other hydrogen atom. They repel each other. If you have enough dust, and that dust comes originally, if you will, from the Big Bang, if you have enough dust in one location, then gravity will start pushing it inward. That'll push those two hydrogen atoms closer and closer to each other until finally the pressure gets great enough for them to produce helium. And when they do, which is what's called a proton-proton reaction, it gives off three things. It gives off light, It gives off the helium, and it gives off a thing called a neutrino, which nobody knows what it actually is. And those products then are what keeps the sun from collapsing further. So the sun is coming in by gravity, and then this reaction in the center is pushing things outward to keep it the same as it is. So it becomes effectively metastable. How's that?
I didn't catch that last part. I'm sorry. It becomes like...
It's metastable. In other words, as long as gravity is balanced by the outward pressure of the energy from the inside, light from the inside, it stays the same size. And it's only when you start running out of material on the inside, the temperatures go down, and then it starts to collapse again, that you go to the next stage from a star.
So a red giant, you're not metastable, or you're going outward. There's more outward pressure because you've expended a lot of your fuel.
Well, what happens is when the hydrogen finally runs out in the center to a good extent, it starts to collapse inward. And when things collapse, get closer together because gravity pushes in harder, it becomes hotter, at which time helium starts to react, and you start getting both hydrogen on the outer ring and helium on the inside going, and that pushes it even bigger. And that becomes the red giant.
All right. Hey, we have to take a break here, Mel, but I hope that helped you. 800-348-2551 is the number, 800-348-2551. The Science Forum on Vox Pop. We'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC, 800-348-2551 is the number. It's the Science Forum. Ed Standard, Jim Pickett, and Barbara Brabets are here to answer your questions. We'll do a quick email here and then jump back to the phones. This one came in from Ian in Saugerties. And Ian writes, I was in my pool Monday night around 9:17 and was delighted to observe the space station going past. I checked the NASA website to confirm that it indeed was in view for about 3 minutes. This made me wonder how it can be so bright if it is presumably in the Earth's shadow while it is traveling over the dark side of the Earth. I then began to wonder about all the other more faint satellites that you can see only on really dark nights that are at a greater distance from Earth. Where is the light that I am observing being reflected from, as I presume they don't glow on their own? And that's from Ian in Saugerties.
Well, basically, the size of the Earth's shadow is not very large. And what you're seeing is the satellite going outside of the Earth's shadow. So, for example, I know it for the moon. During a solar eclipse, the moon is, I don't remember quite what size is, but on the Earth, the shadow of the moon is only 125 miles wide. So you have to be within that shadow to see an actual solar eclipse.
Otherwise, it's partial.
So effectively, as a result, even though the moon is very large, the shadow is quite small. And it's the same thing with the satellites. The satellites passing through are getting reflection from the sun because they're not being blocked by the Earth's shadow.
And that's why you really only get to see the ISS and the other satellites in a few hours after sunset. Once you're in the depths of night, you're in the deeper part of the shadow, and there's no way for the things above you 100 miles or so to still be reflective of sunlight.
And very often, if you follow the track of one of the satellites or the ISS, you'll watch it for a while and then it just blinks out.
Faded away. We watched the ISS. We assume it was the ISS because it was very bright when we were up in Maine and did just that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so that's passing from the sunlight into the shadow.
All right. The number here is 800-348-2551 and we'll jump back on the phones. And Morgan in Williamstown. Morgan, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Ray. My question is fairly general, but I'm curious if any of the panelists have seen a change in or toward a more systems-oriented type of research, almost a philosophical change from reductionist, remove all the variables but one type research toward systems. For instance, hydrogeochemistry research and looking at agronomy from that perspective, or inclusion of animal science with hydrogeochemistry. I say this because I'm a farmer and I do have a background from Cornell, but I'm curious because it seems like so often we miss the boat on the big picture by looking so finitely at very particular characteristics, then make policy without consideration of what the big picture might be. So I'm wondering if there is any kind of movement in that systems thinking direction.
Well, I can start this. Basically, science requires money. And very often the money is determined by the people who look at the grant and decide whether it's worth doing or not. And those people are normally specialists. There are very few generalists out there who are doing work taking areas like hydrogeochemistry and combining it with other areas. So as a result, it's very, very hard to find funding to do that kind of work, to try and make the connections between the sciences, basically because the people who are making the decisions on grants are within one science or another, and they don't really know what to do with it.
Now, I'll give you a slightly different take on the same topic. I asked Ed one time during one of our commutes why he was a geologist. And it was really that systems approach was the basis of his answer, because the experiment that you're observing in geology happened millions or billions of years ago. And you did not have the ability to control all of the factors of that experiment or that activity, right? You don't know, you don't have a positive control or a negative control. It's already done. And you're looking at the remnants of this cataclysm that's in front of you, and you have to discern based on a system. You have to discern what happened down to a level and make sure that it's logical. Now, I'm speaking for a geologist, but there is a way to look at system, identify systems phenomena, and then still be reductionist to the point where you can get research accomplished.
Yeah, I can tell you, if I may, just for a second. As a geologist, I've been working for years with civil engineers. Because civil engineers are very numbers-oriented, and they very often, as a result, miss the forest for the trees. But in certain sciences, such as geology, they're more detective sciences, so it is more a systematic approach that we learn, that we're trained to do. So it turns out to be a much better way of operating. So I get jobs effectively trying to convince engineers that they don't know what they're doing.
Nice. Jim?
Yeah. I think it's a matter that the two approaches are complementary, in that you have to get down into the deep weeds to find new phenomena, to find new explanations. But I agree with you. I think that there is more interdisciplinary work and more applications of that deep weeds research into the broad areas. So, and probably more than in the past, because I think that a number of agencies, in fact, encourage that kind of collaborative approach between disciplines.
Morgan, thanks a lot for the call. Our number here is 800-348-2551. The Science Forum, Barbara Brabets, Ed Stander, and Jim Pickett are here to answer your questions. And we go to Connell in Troy. You're on.
Hi. I had one question, but your discussion has engendered another. My first question has to do with squirrels, and why they don't develop rabies the way other mammals do.
Sure. So rabies is not my specialty, but I will tell you that the body mass of a squirrel is pretty small, right? They're less than a pound. If they were inflicted with rabies, they would die before, there wouldn't be any latency period. They would just up and die. So there's not that phase of where they're out spreading rabies because they're just, it's like they're struck dead. So if rabies were to perpetuate in a squirrel from, say, maybe a raccoon bit a squirrel who then got rabies, it would die so instantly it would end right there.
Okay.
So it very well could be. I believe there is squirrel rabies, but it doesn't end up being an infectious agent because they're just dead too quickly.
Well, that's very comforting because they're everywhere and other mammals have them. So, okay, that's number one. Number two is a fairly simple question engendered by your earlier discussion, and that is related to three options of sunset. And there are three options also for deriving north. Magnetic North, Grid North, True North. Is there some magic in this trilogy of a measurement?
The short answer is no. There is a relationship, okay, but it's a relationship that's man-made. The only north that we can measure easily, if you will, well, I guess that's not true now with GPS, but magnetic north depends on the movement of the core and mantle interface, and that varies over time. So, for example, years ago, Canada had the magnetic north, and now Russia has it. They've taken it over. So every year it changes, and every year you have to make a different adjustment onto your compass in order to take that into consideration. And that adjustment takes it from magnetic north to true north. And that's basically the difference between the two of them, is that one of them is a property, intrinsic property of the Earth, and the other is what we say it is.
And going back to sunrise and sunset, they each have a handiness, each of the three. Right, you don't need astronomical sunset or astronomical sunrise. Really has to do with the penetration of the light to where you are at that moment, and so that has a different use than say a nautical use, where you really need to see the sun go down or see the sun rise in order to orient yourself in this grid that we've created artificially around our planet. So they all have a use. I think the rule of three, you know, if we had four, it gets to kind of be like choices of condiments at a buffet. There's just too much to choose from. Which one am I going to take? I'll take the A1 steak sauce. You know, you at a certain point, people just need to limit the choices of the options. I think if we came up with a new like internet sunrise or internet sunset, if it had a usefulness, it would persist and one of the others would die away.
Yeah, it should be mentioned as well that the only real north that anybody uses in the world is true north. Everything else is defined with respect to true north. So grid north is true north, and magnetic north is around here in Albany is about 13 degrees from true north. So but as long as we only use one, then people don't make mistakes.
Well, it seems to me that you're saying a similar thing, that true north is the bedrock. And then there are these other options that are useful to us. And in terms of the other areas, well, we have, you know, you can interpret it this way or that way, but you have to settle on one and have to decide which one you're going to use. Because if you're going to use map grids, you have to use map grids. And you see the function of that. So I understand, and I thank you for your answers. I appreciate it very much. Cleared up a lot.
Thanks a lot. Jim, did you want to add something?
Yeah, because it is a good example of how the scale of the problem tells you when good enough is good enough. If you're a hunter trying to get your way out of the woods, then magnetic north is probably good enough. If you are driving 100 miles, then the map grid is good enough. If you're piloting an airplane from here to Moscow, then you probably ought to be using true north. So it's a matter of what's good enough for your needs, and that crops up all the time.
And I wonder, in Boy Scouts and in Girl Scouts, we used to do orienteering, right, with maps. I was just on a trip in an area of the country that I wasn't familiar with, and I went to go buy a physical map. Good luck. My GPS was perfectly fine, but I wanted to kind of peruse the map and kind of plan, and it's really hard to do that with a little box.
Yeah.
And I think a true north is what the GPS grids are pretty much on, and so we've gotten away from that handiness of being able to look in the corner of the map at the legend and see how magnetic north and true north really are oriented in that section. Most people wouldn't even know what that little wedgy thing is on a map, but yet we were taught that and got a badge for it when we were kids.
Yeah, and the grid is an interesting thing. I noticed last time I was flying cross country, you know, over the Midwest, where the roads go north and south and east and west, as they say, as they were intended to do.
Right.
How you have a road that's supposed to be going true north, but in order to maintain square miles, that doesn't work on the surface of a sphere. So every certain distance, I don't know what it is, 10 or 20 miles, you can see how the roads jog over a little bit. So they maintain the square miles, but you can't do that with the roads running true north. They run on a flat grid.
Very interesting. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Jim Pickett, Ed Stander, and Barbara Brabitz here on the Science Forum. We go to Dave in Voorheesville. Dave, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. It's a great show. I have kind of a mundane question about the ubiquitous household batteries. I'm talking that you have D batteries, C batteries, AA's, AAA's. They're all 1.5 volts, and obviously they're all different in size. Is there any other difference? That's my basic question. So one, would you expect one to last longer than another? And why, basically, what's the basic difference between the sizes?
For those, as you were describing, I think the chemistry is the same in all
absolutely
those,
the same
the batteries.
Yep.
So the only difference is size. You know, you put the big ones in the flashlight and the little ones in your remote control. Now, as you go to other kinds of batteries, like hearing aid batteries or the little batteries in a watch, that's different chemistry, and the voltage will be a little bit different.
But the basic thing between AA batteries and AAA batteries is storage capacity. D batteries last 10 times as long as an AA battery. And so if you put an AA battery, at least in the old days, in a flashlight with an incandescent light bulb, it wouldn't last very long.
Yeah, like a night. It wouldn't last more than a night or two.
Right, but you put a D battery in there, it'll last much longer. So
and the old lantern cells, the old big fat lantern cells.
Oh, you remember those things, those 9-volters?
Yeah.
But the funny thing is,
6-volt.
A number of years ago, a major retailer in the country was producing C batteries and D batteries, and somebody took it upon themselves to cut one of the D batteries open and discovered it was just a C battery inside, and they'd run wires up to the top.
So the milliamp hours weren't the
so
D capacity.
The storage was the same as a C battery, but it fit the size of a D battery.
I don't think they're in business anymore.
What'd you say, Dave?
I'm sorry, I think you've answered my question. So the larger batteries, I would expect to last longer.
Yes, much longer.
More chemicals.
It's the same chemical, just more of it.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like supersizing your meal.
All right, Dave.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it very much. Over to Joe in Del Mar. Joe, you're on.
Hi, I got a question about clouds. Two parts. Number one, I guess clouds are made up of drops of water, and I'm wondering why we're looking at them. What gives them a defined shape? You know, where does the cloud end and begin? The second part is, what's different about a fair weather clouds that I'm looking at now, simple cloud cover, and storm clouds? That's it.
Okay, hang in there.
You want to take it?
No, I really don't.
Well, basically, what makes a cloud, as you say, are the water droplets. And what makes a cloud look the way it does is that the light coming in from the sky passes through the water droplets, and it...
gets scattered.
Scatters, yeah. It's called Raleigh scattering. And that scattering altogether makes the white color that you see inside of a cloud.
What about the shapes?
You need enough of them together in order to get the Raleigh scattering effect.
The shape is the nature of the cloud, if you want, the cloud of water that's there. And it's there because as water rises, as you go up from the surface of the earth, air gets thinner. And as it does, it cools. You get what's called adiabatic cooling. And there comes a point where the water vapor in the atmosphere becomes droplets. And when it becomes droplets, it begins to scatter the light.
Now, when you come to storm clouds, usually you get that darker green or black color, and that's not just water. Usually we have ice crystals that are forming in there, or you have seeds of dirt or fine ash that then have water wrapped around it. So if you think of hail is just a water droplet that's been through the ringer. It's gone up and down and up and down and up and down inside this car wash of a storm cloud, and then had aggregates of ice put on aggregates of ice, kind of like an onion, until it gets heavy enough so that the upward forces can't be overcome, or are overcome rather, and then it falls to the ground. There was just a video, just an astonishing video, I think it was in Colorado, of 3-inch baseball, actually softball size hail bombs coming out of this storm in the Midwest. That killed two animals in a zoo, a duck and a turkey, yeah. I think. Turkey vulture, maybe, died. And the polar bear, there's video of the polar bear, like, hiding in his enclosure, trying to not get hit by these things. So it's amazing to think that that's so much upward force that it created this softball-sized ball of snow, and then it finally came back down.
Yeah. Well, let's take a quick break here. Our number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. The Science Forum. We'll be back. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. 800-348-2551 is the number if you want to call. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. And our panel of scientists, Ed Stander, Jim Pickett, and Barbara Brabitz, here to answer your questions. Here's a quick email. Actually, not so quick. This one's from Larry, and the subject heading is time-space stuff. So get ready, panel.
Oh, boy.
Several questions. Here we go.
Get my slide roll.
There is a star that is 5 light years away. Therefore, on Earth, the light and events we perceive from it are 5 years old. If someone was approaching that star from Earth, what would happen to the image received? That's the first question. Would the traveling observer see the events at that star proceeding at an accelerated rate directly proportional to velocity?
If it was going the same speed as light, then it would be moving with the front, and so it would arrive. It would see effectively a moment in time that would never change.
But okay. I think the question was reversed. Yeah. You're traveling right towards the object that's traveling
towards
you.
Or away?
Yeah. The traveling observer, someone approaching that star. Yes, we were traveling
okay,
toward
we're
that star.
We're going towards the star.
Yes.
So you see it slightly fast. You so see it slightly faster. Earlier. Yep.
All right. Also, can you explain the effect of time dilation near a supermassive object? And that's from Larry.
Short answer is no.
Oh. How about it's a phenomenon?
Oh, that's great. That's great. All
right, it's a Bob Berman.
Well, congratulations, Larry. You've stumped the panel, although I suspect Ed probably has something up his sleeve here.
Yeah, well, fortunately I'm wearing short sleeves, so I'm not going
to
say a thing.
All right. Back to
wait,
the
before we go to the phones, oh, can yes. I just... tell everyone that Ed and I will soon be busy, and Jim not so much, he's still retired. Our semester starts in 2 weeks.
Oh, that's exciting.
Isn't it? So yeah. August 27th, Monday, is the start of the college semester at SUNY Cobleskill. And in our area, we have 2 new degree programs that are starting up.
Mm-hmm.
Your listeners on Food Friday may be interested. One of them is Applied Fermentation.
Ha!
I think Ray is going to sign up.
No.
And the second one is fermentation science. They're both bachelor's degrees, and they're meant to train people for either science endeavors with fermentation. So the making of insulin, for example, is done with a fermentation route, or making of foodstuffs like beer, wine, yogurt, whiskey. We actually have a distilling class that's gone through curriculum committee, and I think all of curriculum committee was willing to attend a class.
Is whiskey a foodstuff?
It is.
This is a great revelation for me.
Yes, I think it counts.
Time for dinner.
It's one of the 3 major food groups, actually.
All right.
And I would like to mention as well that we already have the RNA pills ready for the classes.
Oh, right. So the memory, we can have whiskey memory?
That's right.
Okay.
I've had a few whiskey memories. Let's go back to the phones. And Timothy and Troy. Timothy, you're on.
Hey, how's it going?
Okay.
So this question might be a bit of a stretch, but... you know, when you drop something that has mass, it falls to the Earth and gets pulled by the Earth with that force, and the Earth also gets pulled on that by that object with that same force.
With a proportionate force, yes.
Yep. And that causes a small displacement of the Earth, very small, like smaller than a proton small.
Okay.
And I was just curious, what happens when you get a mass that is so small that the displacement caused by the attraction between the two is smaller than a Planck length?
Hmm. So you're talking about grand unified theory going from mass as we understand it down to the quantum level, and when does stuff change? Because we know that the way things respond are different whether we're dealing in classical matter or whether we're dealing with quantum matter.
Right.
And there's a two distinct different sets of conditions that things operate by. And as we shrink and go from the classical heavy sense, you know, you, me, the flower, down to the quantum sense that is smaller than an electron, the things change. So we don't know how it transitions. We just know what's on the two ends of the spectrum, and we're trying to figure that out as a group of scientists. That's like Ben.
I understand that.
Okay, so Stephen Hawking's work has been to try to figure out what that grand unified theory is. Many people have tried before them. People theorized that Einstein was onto something and just ran out of his lifetime.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Yep, that makes sense.
All right, Timothy, thanks a lot for calling the program. We appreciate it. Over to Robin in Cooperstown. Robin.
Hi. I've been listening to your program, and the question about rabies and squirrels.
Mm.
Yes.
That they were too small. And I thought, okay, that kind of makes sense. And then I said, well, what about bats?
That's true. Bats are pretty light.
Yeah, I think they're probably smaller than some squirrels. And yet they're known for carrying rabies.
Right, yes. because they have more of a built-in resistance to rabies than squirrels do. So I did check on our break to see if indeed I was correct that squirrels can carry rabies, and they can, and they die very quickly, as I had surmised before. But bats, of course, have a history, an evolutionary history of dealing with rabies. They can't really survive it either, but there is a resistance in these species, or the family, rather, of bats, where they can linger, unfortunately, before they succumb.
So they last long enough to spread the disease.
Exactly. Then. And there are strains of rabies that bats carry that other mammals don't carry. So I'm putting air quotes up on the air, but there's bat rabies and raccoon rabies and bear rabies.
Uh-huh.
Different variants that you'd find in different populations.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
It's bad for the bats.
There's bear rabies?
There's bear rabies.
Yikes. Okay.
Just run faster. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, right?
You see if the bear's coming at you.
That's a good point. Kevin in Great Barrington. Kevin, you're on.
Yes, great show, guys. I've been following you for years. I was wondering if the panelists could comment on the influence of geoengineering on cloud formations and the weather.
Okay. So if you see a smokestack that's coming out of, a power plant in Albany on a cold winter's day, you can see the obvious water vapor that's condensing above the smokestacks, and it can either dissipate or become part of the cloud landscape. And other geological features like hot springs or geysers do the same. And as far as anytime you're adding a gas to the environment, it's going somewhere. It's just whether we're seeing it with our eyes. Is that your question, Kevin?
No, I'm talking about the engineering geo trails you see coming from planes that cover the sky.
What's happening in those cases is really very simple. You're taking a gas, air, and you're compressing it very strongly, and coming out the other end, it expands. And as it expands, it becomes colder, and that causes the air around it, and to some extent, the air that went through the engine, to form water molecules.
No, it's the combustion products of the fuel
that generates
a great deal of water vapor, and that with the cooling as it expands. Causes the trail, but you don't need to go through a jet engine to make that kind of trail. I mean, contrails were commonly observed in World War II, mm-hmm. from piston engine planes, and in fact, you generate the same thing when you exhale in the wintertime and
make
the little.
What about the? I was just specifically talking about the engineering spraying that they're doing. It has nothing to do with the engines. This is a planned program, geoengineering.
Well, not well. That's not going on now.
That went on in the '60s.
Well, yeah, there was the attempts of rainmaking. Maybe what you're referring to is the thoughts about putting salt particles or sulfur dioxide into the air to cause nucleation of clouds to reduce global warming. But that's not being practiced. That's off into the future.
And that's a thought exercise, yes, mostly.
All right, Kevin, thanks for the call. It's the Science Forum on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. We have Barbara Brabets, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander here to answer your questions in the waning moments. Go ahead, Ed.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that for those who are going to be outside this weekend that the Perseides meteor shower is going to reach its peak probably on Saturday or Sunday.
That's good.
And they're expecting on the order of 100 to 150 meteors an hour.
Okay. And I think the weather's supposed to be decent in
our
immediate area.
Clear. And we'll have a new moon.
Oh, that's perfect.
So it'll be dark.
Very nice.
So get out in the countryside and see it. It'll be worth seeing.
Yeah, away from artificial light. That's the key to that. All right. Marsha in Wurtsboro, you're on.
Yes, I was just wondering about all the polyester clothes and you know, the straws and cups and everything else that are made out of plastics. What is the feasibility of having those, melted down or whatever so that we don't have to take out more petroleum out of the ground?
Well, some of the more highly valuable plastics, like polyester, that can and is recycled. So your water bottles can end up as carpet fiber or things like that. The higher volume, cheaper plastics, like polyethylene, polypropylene, the problem with recycling those is that the different grades don't mix together very well. And it's difficult to get a high-value item. They can be kind of mushed together and make playground lumber and stuff, but it's hard to get high-value products out of those plastics.
But it's not an unsolvable problem. We can work on it, and many people in Jim's business do that.
Yeah.
One of the ways that, like right now, we do not have a great way of recycling clothing. I think everyone knows that there's a box at their local church or their parking lot that they can stick stuff in, and those textiles are bundled in bulk, sold really as a commodity, and then either used as turned into the padding underneath carpets or sold to third world countries to help clothe individuals. There's not like a true recycling program per se to add value to that. But I think we could do better with that. Also, if you think of large venues, say like Yankee Stadium, where you could regulate the cups that you have or the types of straws, you have a large enough plastic stream that's pure enough that you could make a high-value recycled material out of.
And of course, the problem with all of this is that most of our recycling was done in China, and they have now said that they don't want our plastics anymore.
Well,
so
the tariffs
are going to
here. We're going to have to do it in-house.
All right. Well, thanks for the call, Marsha. We appreciate it. Let's go over to Gail in Oneonta. Hi, Gail.
Hi. I would like to know if there's a big difference between using potassium chloride and sodium chloride in my cooking, other than there would be a taste, and I can't think of the word I want, but you can get a taste for the potassium chloride versus the sodium chloride, which makes you retain fluid.
So Gail, can you taste the difference? I can't taste the difference between sodium and potassium chloride.
But I like my potassium chloride. I know that medically you have to be careful you don't get your potassium too high.
Exactly.
But I have a problem that I go the other way. So.
Right. So you pretty much answered your own question. There is a difference between sodium chloride and potassium chloride physiologically, and there are certain organs that are susceptible to either or. In particular, if you have a kidney issue, potassium is not one that you necessarily want to have in high volume in your diet. So you'll often, if you have a kidney issue, your doctor will tell you, please don't eat bananas because they're high in potassium, or to limit your salt intake because commercial salts or industrial salts that are on foods that are processed are usually a mixture of both sodium and potassium, because the only one they have to report on the side of the label is sodium. So in order to make it salty to our taste, they'll add the potassium chloride in there. It'll still be in the list of ingredients, but not on the label.
Very interesting.
All right. Okay.
Well, thanks, Gail.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. All right, we have a minute or two here, and we really never talked about this rogue planet.
Oh, the rogue planet.
And that is how many light years away?
200?
20.
20.
It's pretty That's close.
Very close. Wow. And this is some 12 times larger than Jupiter?
Yes, I think so. Jupiter's pretty big.
And if it was any bigger, it would be called a brown dwarf rather than a planet.
All right. And this gets back to one of our callers. It's on a continuum, basically, where if it got more massive, it would ignite.
Yeah.
Well, if you have a planet that's large enough to get fusion to start occurring in the center, then we call it a star.
Right.
If it's hot enough, if it's large enough that the gravity becomes great enough that within the center things start to rub together an awful lot and it produces a lot of heat, then it can still be a planet. So Pluto, for example, gives off more heat than it gets from the sun because it's large enough. And it does this, but it's certainly not large enough to be a sun. It would have to be about 75 times larger.
And one of the interesting things about this rogue planet that they have discovered is that it has a huge or very strong magnetic field. And
right.
Do we know why?
Well, if you put gases such as hydrogen and helium under a lot of pressure, a lot of heat, then the electrons start to strip off. And when electrons become free, then the material becomes magnetic.
So even stuff that normally wouldn't be magnetic can be magnetic under those circumstances.
Right.
And even if this thing is not ignited, it's still giving off a fair amount of heat.
Sure.
Well, they call it glowing. In the lay literature, it says it's a glowing planet, which I think goes back to that phenomenon that Jupiter has where it gives off more heat.
Right. We wouldn't
heat
be able
than
to find it,
it
otherwise.
Gets.
You find it through using infrared light.
Yeah.
And as a result, you can tell what it is. And the reason it's a rogue planet is because it's not near a star. So it's a glowing mass that's sitting out in the middle of nowhere.
Drifting through space.
And it says that it's only 200 million years old, which on the scheme of things is really newborn. So it hasn't yet found its place in the universe.
Is it heading our way? Should we be frightened?
I think we've got a little bit of time.
Astronomers have been thinking for a long time that if you look at comets, long-term comets all seem to come out of the same part of the sky towards us. And people have argued for years that there's probably a rogue planet within the cloud that surrounds our solar system, the Oort cloud,
well,
that could be producing that.
A great way to end the program. Support comes from Watercolors by Edith Shutesbury, Massachusetts. Edith Hunsberger, a painter in acrylic on watercolors, specializing in portrait paintings of people and pets from photographs. Edith-Hunsberger.artistwebsite.com. Studio KTM, Salon, Red Hook, specializing in all phases of cut and organic color, from corrective to fashion, by stylist Kristen Marquette, studioktm.com. Saratoga Jewish Cultural Festival, presenting Schlock Rock, an international Israeli rock band performing in Hebrew and English, August 12th, 7 p.m. at Filene Hall, Skidmore College, 518-584-8730, extension 2 for reservations. And Vermont Coffee Company, organic coffee in the brown paper bag, now roasted with renewable energy. Vermont Coffee Company, coffee roasted for friends. Thanks again to Jim Pickett, Ed Stander, and Barbara Bravitz for being here. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Deb Malik took your calls. Our producer is James Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, Food Friday, Chef Rick Orlando returns for outdoor cooking and barbecue inside, oddly enough. We'll see you then.